Czech Chamber Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Marek Stilic. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. Thank you for your company. I do hope you've enjoyed listening as much as I've enjoyed presenting the programme for you. Next week, my singing star is the adorable soprano Anna Moffo. We'll be hearing the last of Haydn's Opus 76 quartets, played by the Angelis Quartet. And my middle hour is on a theme, actually two themes, of Corelli, which, aside from music by the man himself, will include works by Rachmaninoff and Tippett. So please do join me same time next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
We look forward to it, Rob. But Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
Before Hollywood blockbusters and long before TV period drama, great works of literature were brought to life through music, notably by Robert Schumann. He's this week's Composer of the Week, and we're exploring his musical adaptations of some of the great writers of the poems, novels and stories that inspired him. From Hans Christian Andersen to Robert Burns, from E.T.A. Hoffmann to Goethe, Schumann brought some of their greatest works to life in his music. Join me, Donald McLeod, to hear stories become music in the hands of Robert Schumann, our Composer of the Week, starting tomorrow from midday and repeated at 6:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this Sunday. It's just gone midday and time now for Private Passions. And Michael Barclay's guest is the novelist Jill Peyton Walsh.
An irresistible blend of intellect and passion is how the work of Jill Peyton Walsh has been described, and her prolific output spans nearly 50 years of children's books, literary fiction, and detective novels. She's best known for her medieval philosophical novel, Knowledge of Angels. But although Jill was already a well-known author, the book was initially turned down by publishers, so she and her husband published the book themselves, and it went on to be shortlisted for the Booker Prize. She's also enjoyed great success for taking on the mantle of Dorothy L. Sayers and continuing the Lord Peter Wimsey and Harriet Vane detective stories. The winner of many literary prizes, including the Whitbread and the Smarties Prize, she was awarded a CBE in 1996 for services to literature. And I know, Jill, that throughout your career, music has been important to you. And in fact, looking at your list, I can see that you really do love music, that you're a connoisseur and know what you like too.
Well, I'm going to disown connoisseur immediately. I'm not musical. I can't read music. And I can only sing because of the tonic sol fa system, according to which I was taught. But I've absolutely needed music to resolve emotion in my life. I think the really musical people think that's a misuse of music. I've been reproached in my life for that, but that is how I like it. I play some music to myself every day. You've got feelings washing around, and often, of course, linked to thoughts. It's not as though music was not cerebral, because it's very cerebral. But if you are in the grip of emotion, it can often pin it down for you, express it perfectly, and persuade you that it's a human situation and not a personal situation that you're struggling with. And for that reason, I've found it very comforting all my life.
And one of your early books, A School for Lovers, was based, wasn't it, on Mozart's Così fan tutte?
That infuriating work, yes. I think any self-respecting woman could possibly not be infuriated by Così fan tutte. And I was. And angry at it, because before your very eyes, the men are unfaithful first.
And allegedly to test their betrayal.
Well, yes. This isn't an original theme. It goes back to Boccaccio and beyond to Ovid. And in some of the earlier versions, the woman is so justifiably outraged at having been tested that she dispatches the man from her life altogether, which I think is a natural reaction to this. However, Da Ponte, the librettist, was a cynical old wretch. And the thing that became electrifying for me was struggling with Così fan tutte, because the music is beautiful. And then realising that the librettist and the composer were at odds with each other. The music undercuts the libretto. And in a very interesting way, it really denies the idea that the early allegiances of these couples are false. It's telling you something else. It's telling you the opposite, how deeply felt and sincere at the time adolescent love can be. And most people don't want that lesson. They really want to feel, if it isn't permanent, it wasn't really genuine. And I think that's a gross simplification, and Mozart was quietly writing against the thesis in the libretto. You have to admit, if you agree with that, it's pretty fascinating.
Do you think, therefore, that in a way he was using the framework of artifice as something that he could put his own flesh on?
Oh, of course he was. And Mozart really did understand women. He knew a lot about women, and he instinctively understood them. I mean, I think his is the most perfect expression of love known to me in any aria, although that aria is in Don Giovanni, and it's Dalla Sua Pace.
The one you've chosen from this opera is Come Scoglio, isn't it?
Yes, because it's the one that people accuse of being demonstrably overdramatic and therefore false. It is indeed dramatic, but I think that it's just a wrong deduction, that there's anything wrong with being dramatic when you're in love.
Thank you.
Montserrat Caballé singing the aria Come Scoglio, Like a Rock, from Mozart's Così fan tutte. Colin Davis conducting the orchestra of the Royal Opera House. Now, you worked, Jill, as a teacher after university and then started writing children's books when you had your own family. And you've written everything from picture books to historical novels for older children. Do you particularly love writing for children?
Oh, yes. I started doing it like that because I was 23. I didn't think I knew anything very much about adult life, but I knew what to be liked. I'd been teaching them. Mm. But actually, it's much more interesting technically to write for children because if you're writing for adults, there are two people in the room, yourself and the reader. You're roughly equal, supposed to be equal in understanding. If you're writing for children, there are four people in the room. There's the adult you are now, the child you used to be, the child who is the reader now, and the adult that child will become. So it's a much more complicated transaction, and it makes me think deeply. Also, I think children are more important than adults because they have more possibilities ahead of them than adults.
Rather appropriate, then, that we are going to hear part of Albert Herring, since this was written very much with childhood past in mind. And there's a great deal of sort of rough and tumble in it. You know, Britain was in many ways, I always think, rather childlike himself.
Well, I think he was. And remember, it was children who were going to inherit the kingdom of heaven. And there, I mean, childhood innocence is not a negative quality for most Christian thinkers. I don't think Britain was a particularly Christian thinker, but we inherit a Christian world, whether we wanted it or not. It comes along with us over our shoulders. I can remember playground games. I can remember the playground being full of singing, and the tune of children singing and playing without adult supervision, independently doing what they want to do until the bell goes and they've got to get back in the classroom, is something that fills me with nostalgia. And the passages in Albert Herring practically bring me to tears because we no longer let children go off and sing and skip and run about and do what they like. They're always supervised, driven to and fro and supervised. And the playground game and the playground song has practically been lost. I think that the childhoods of my own childhood were in many ways freer and richer than what we permit children today. So, as I say, I love this piece because he stood on the edge of the playground and listened. It's not exactly, of course, any real childhood skipping rhyme or something, but it does have what Edward Blishen called a daft, battered quality, which he said nursery rhymes had.
Yes, because this is the bit where Harry and his friends lose their ball during a game, and Harry has to retrieve it rather stealthily from Albert Herring's grocer's shop.
Yes, I think you probably got into trouble for kicking a ball into a grocer's shop in any time horizon you like to think about.
The opening of the second scene of Benjamin Britten's Albert Herring, Stuart Bedford conducting the Northern Sinfonia, and the children were Yvette Bonner, Temimé Bowling, and Matthew Long. Music, Jill, that celebrates a childhood. You had a Catholic childhood, so was music and liturgy and ritual a part of that?
Oh, definitely. Mass every morning. But, of course, only Latin music. And I can actually read plain song, but was never taught to read ordinary music. It was in some ways very narrow and in other ways very wide. I mean, it did, for example, entail the history of Christendom rather than the history of the British Isles, for which I'm grateful. And I'm also grateful for the fact that I can still read Latin, which has been an enormous enrichment for me. However, I did leave the church rather deliberately and precipitately when I was 26, and I've never regretted that.
Why did you leave?
It's a bit personal. I was in the confessional and the priest asked me to promise something I couldn't promise. So I walked out.
Your novel, Knowledge of Angels, is actually suffused with theological ideas. It's set on an imaginary Mediterranean island in the medieval period. And I think you said that this was the book that you were born to write. And I'd love to know what you mean by that.
Well, it gathers together all my childhood experience of religion, but from a distance. And I think that, how can I put it? I think if you go back to the book of Genesis, the apple on the tree of the knowledge of good and evil should not have been knowledge, it should have been certainty. The book is an attack on certainty. And at the time I wrote it, Salman Rushdie was under a fatwa for being a heretic, and his life was at risk. And I was infuriated by some comments, you see, that said, oh, the Muslims do this sort of thing, but the Christians don't. And I found out when the last person had been punished, physically punished for heresy in Europe. And the answer is 1810. I mean, only just the day before yesterday, Christians were doing it too. And so this theme simply grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and wouldn't put me down till I'd written it.
Well, for many people, Mozart, Bach and Beethoven are kind of gods, aren't they? And you've got more Mozart now, but a different sort from Così fan tutte, because this is the Mozart Requiem, a profoundly moving piece, especially given the history that he died before is finished and Süssmayr had to finish it. And I wonder what it speaks to you of as a lapsed Catholic.
Well, it speaks to me exactly of that, of the magnificence of Catholic ritual, of the magnificence of the Catholic view of the universe. I mean, to believe it false is not to fail to see its beauty. Its beauty is deeply enticing. And Mozart was a devout Catholic. He is, so to speak, the antiphon of Bach, who was a devout Protestant. The Requiem was also a work in Latin, and I, you know, you can leave the church, but you can't leave the first 25 years of your own life. And so Latin has got a tremendous pull for me. And also,
speaking
of course,
as an ex-chorister at Westminster Cathedral, I can
oh, are you, Michael?
All
Hooray.
Too clearly. Oh, yes. No. And so actually when suddenly that was thrown out, it was as though everything had been that one had been taught was absolutely fundamental to Catholic teaching.
Yes.
Had just sort of, oh, well, that's gone.
I can imagine that. The only time I've heard a Mass since I left the church was when John, my husband, and I were looking at Baroque churches in Prague, and we entered one in which a Latin Mass was being said. And I simply stood at the back and heard it out. I mean, the other thing about the Requiem, of course, is that it's unfinished. Mm. And I think this is nearly blasphemous, but of course I too have picked up unfinished work. And the spot the join game is much easier, I think, in the Requiem, because there's historical evidence that suggests he'd finished the Dies Irae, but not actually more than sketched, if indeed he had as much as sketched anything else. And I don't think you would realise that if you didn't know the story at all. So I don't think you can spot the join starting from total ignorance.
I think it's pretty good, most of it. And, of course, a lot of it actually develops ideas that Mozart had written down.
Yes. I'm not making accusations against those who finished it. An unfinished work is disabled. It's difficult.
But it can be wonderful, don't you think? I think many sketches are better than the oil paintings that that are based on them.
Exactly. And if anybody wants to prove that to themselves, let them just go and look at the Turner that's on show in London, in which nobody can tell whether the late pictures are finished or not. There's an impertinence in finishing somebody else's work. But I shouldn't say so because I've done it myself. And since me, and this wasn't the case when I did it, loads of people have picked up, especially detectives of the past, and begun to add to their corpus.
So do you think, listening to this as we're about to the Recordare, that Mozart was also a forgiving person?
Oh, absolutely. I think of all the composers I can think of, he's the one most moved by forgiveness. And in the operas, there's always a clue to it because he's using the horn, which is such an unexpected choice of instrument to do this melting effect. But when he orchestrates for the horn, he melts you. And this, of course, I've chosen the Recordare because that's the plea for forgiveness. And it seems to me whoever you are and whatever your religious background, and Latin or not, we can all empathise with that. Well, you've only got to compare that with Verdi's Requiem to see the difference between someone who is, so to speak, cosmically fearful and someone who trusts in the goodness of God. I think Mozart was melting there.
Yes.
He does melt from time to time, and when he does so, he always melts me as well.
A sort of humble supplication.
Yes.
Also, I think the interesting thing there is that we had, you mentioned, two operatic composers, but Mozart eschews the operatic when writing sacred music, doesn't he? Whereas Verdi cannot resist it. I mean, it's wonderful
yes,
too, but it's very
It is
different.
Wonderful too, but it is very different. Mm. And the emotional timbre is completely different. And I think if you put them side by side, you can more easily see the difference between them. It identifies the essence of each composer to make that comparison.
The Recordare from the Mozart Requiem. Peter Schreier conducting the Staatskapelle Dresden, and the soloists were Margaret Price, Trudelisa Schmidt, Francisco Araiza, and Theo Adam. And by the way, you can find details of all Jill Peyton-Walsh's choices on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Talking of finishing projects, Jill, you immersed yourself in a huge finishing project, didn't you, involving Lord Peter Whimsey?
Well, I didn't know how huge it was. I mean, I naively thought if I rescued this fragment by Dorothy L. Sayers and made it publishable, I was paying a debt, because I would not have had the effrontery to apply for Oxford if I hadn't read Gaudy Night when I was 14. And I fell in love with the idea of the academic life for a woman, which wasn't that obvious in my upbringing. And so I felt I owed her something, and by rescuing her abandoned fragment, I could, so to speak, repay the debt. What I didn't expect and should have done was that if it failed, that would have been the end of it, and probably me. But if it succeeded, they were going to want more and more and more. There is simply no end to the number of people who adore Lord Peter and want more and more and more.
So this was Thrones Dominations. Do you think readers enjoy... You were talking about Spot the Join. Do you think they enjoy trying to spot the join in your writing here?
I'm sure they do, and I'm glad to tell you that nobody so far has managed to do it. In fact, there's an odd thing, which is that when people write to me and say, Dorothy Sayers would never have written this or thought that, it has, with only one exception, been something that she actually had written and did think. Mm-hmm. It sticks out because it's period, because it was written in the 30s. So it sort of sticks out if you're reading it in the 21st century. And therefore people think that that's a mistake on my part. Whereas actually what it is fidelity to the original author, who was, after all, in the past. People are not very critical, you know. They would love to find the joins, but if they can't, they relax.
Well, actually, we're going to go on to a piece of collaboration, aren't we? Because it's an example of someone taking on another artist's work. Because Bizet wrote this piece originally as a vocal duet for his opera, The Fair Maid of Perth. And it was after his death, I think, that Ernest Giro orchestrated it.
Do you know, I didn't know that. Yeah. How fascinating.
And it reminds you of happy times, doesn't it?
It reminds me of very happy times. It reminds me of... good friends who we met on a cruise down the Rhone and who decided they liked the cruising but not all the other passengers. So they hired the whole boat themselves the following year and filled it with their friends.
Yes, could and have been a sort of Hercule Poirot situation.
It could have been a Poirot situation. It was actually simply relaxation with very compatible other people. John and I had a wonderful holiday and have always felt thankful to our friends. When I put the photographs into a DVD for my fellow passengers, I chose this as the accompanying music, so it reminds me.
Thank you.
The crews on the boat that I'm remembering with such pleasure included calling at Arles.
So La Lessienne could not have been more appropriate.
I believe it could not, no.
Charles Dutoit conducting the Montreal Symphony Orchestra in the minuet from Bizet's La Lessienne Suite No. 2. T.S. Eliot takes us to our next music, and of course he is such a musical poet. It's been a very important connection for you, Eliot, hasn't it?
Oh, yes, it has. I don't think it possible to be a writer in the 20th century without being influenced by Eliot. The connection with Schubert, however, was created for me by a long television documentary about T.S. Eliot, which used this music in the background persistently as the leitmotif and the encapsulation of the mood. I did know and love the music before I watched the programme, but indeed Eliot is an enormous presence in the 20th century. And an enormous presence in the life of anybody who loves to read poetry. I mean, some of John's favourite passages from Eliot were his young poems, poems about the New England fall and early stuff, which is not difficult or abstruse in any way, and which he deserted later.
So was it also very much your husband, John, who actually focused your attention on Eliot?
Well, I think so, really. I mean, that was one of many profoundly shared and profound experiences which brought us and kept us together.
You do write poetry, don't you?
I do write poetry, but it's private. Mm. That's to say, I don't try to make it reach a wide audience. Mm. I try to make it encapsulate something I want to remember for myself. And so I don't only show it to the very closest friends.
Would you mind if they were ever published these, perhaps posthumously?
That's a really hard question, because I can't judge. If they were going to ruin my reputation, I would mind, except I won't be there to mind if it's posthumous.
But it's an interesting question, because I think it's one that estates often face. So we'll have to leave that hanging then, and your executors will still be none the wiser after listening to this programme. The music that this leads to is one of the great moments in musical history, in my view.
I agree with that. I think it's as profound as any music I've ever listened to. Everybody knows who the three greats are. I mean, they're Bach, Mozart and Beethoven. And I always say, and Schubert. And some of my musical friends, they don't think Schubert quite makes the alpha class. Well, I don't care whether he's alpha compared to the others. He's the one I love most deeply. And this has an alternation between the most deep and meditative emotional sympathy of some kind and agitation. I've always loved this, but at the moment it's reminding me strongly of the way I feel about my husband, who died in March, that all recollections of life with him are like the calm passages of this. But there's also the agitation of the world suddenly transformed by his absence.
Thank you. The pizzicato cello is like a sort of fragile heartbeat almost, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
The Cleveland Quartet, with Yo-Yo Ma playing the cello in the opening of the Adagio from Schubert's Great Quintet in C major. Well, that was Schubert's final chamber work, written just 2 months before he died at the age of 32. Because of his early death, I suppose Schubert is rather fixed in our minds as a young man, as is Mozart. I'm quite interested that you've not allowed Peter Whimsey to remain fixed in our minds as a young man, but have allowed him to get older. And in fact, in your most recent book, he and Harriet Vane are a middle-aged married couple with student-aged children.
Well, you see, of all the subjects open to a writer of fiction, the least explored is that of long, happy marriages. And I'm enchanted by the opportunity to show that particular pair maturing and still basically in love with each other and working well together. All around me, there are people, real people, who have exactly that experience. And in literature, where are they? There's Mr. and Mrs. Croft in Persuasion. There's possibly Kitty and Levin in Anna Karenina. This is a subject people don't find entrancing. And I do find it entrancing. And because I'm in love with Peter Whimsey, as anybody who reads Beyond Him can tell, and because I identify with Harriet Vane very easily, this subject comes naturally to me, and it's partly born of a personal experience, which is shared by many people and hardly ever written about.
Well, just as well, then, that you're going to have a composer who I often think of as being quintessentially happy and amusing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Haydn is optimistic, sane, perfectly sensitive, perfectly perceptive. He's the only nice man, yourself excepted, of course, Michael, whom I know as a composer. The thing that actually set me on to Haydn originally, I told you I wasn't musical to start with, but I was reading a biography of Mozart in which I read that Haydn had said to Leopold Mozart, "Before God, sir, your son is the greatest composer known to me, either by reputation or by performance." And that, considering he was the grand old man of music, was so generous. So I knew some Haydn. I went rushing around finding Haydn and finding now that he comforts me for any pessimism or miserable prospect in the world. It's sweet reason, isn't it, that sings out of Haydn.
And what have you chosen to sing on this occasion?
Well, I noticed that my list didn't contain any piano music, which is ridiculous because I adore the piano. The notes sound liquid. They sound like clear water.
Especially when played as here by Brendel.
The great pianist, yes. I mean, so I thought, well, I must have some Haydn and I must have some piano music. And so this is what I found.
Thank you. Alfred Brendel with great joie de vivre, playing the first movement of Haydn's Piano Sonata No. 50 in D major. Jill Peyton-Walsh, earlier this year you lost your husband, the children's writer and critic John Rowe Townsend, and immediately after his death you were taken seriously ill, and I wondered how this has changed your outlook on life.
Well, it's hard to say. I think if I didn't have children and grandchildren, I would probably take myself off to Switzerland at this stage. But I do have, and I'm surrounded by loving friends
and
loving
your work,
family.
Of course.
I suppose I shall be able to work again next year. I can't at the moment, but I have written ever such a lot of books. And the sun still shines. And memory is my friend, because I had 40 years of profound happiness with John. And so it is a long time. First as his mistress, because things were complicated, and then finally as his wife. And in all that time, we never had a cross word. So that all I have to do to cheer myself up is recall to my mind some episode in the past which was wonderful and bask in the memory.
And you're off to Massachusetts to celebrate him.
Well, our American friends want to celebrate him, and I'm going to join them. We worked in America together every summer for better than 35 years. We have a lot of friends in America. And, of course, it was in America that I first encountered Copland, which was given to me as an orchestral version by an American friend, saying, this is what Americans can do. But actually, it's the words that seduced us. And these are the right words. Since then, the tune has been captured and set to hippie-type words about the Lord of the Dance, which is entirely inauthentic. The authentic words come from the Shaker community and go like this. 'Tis a gift to be simple. 'Tis a gift to be free. 'Tis a gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend we shan't be ashamed. To turn, turn, will be our delight, till by turning, turning, we come round right. And I think that pretty perfectly makes a history of my relationship with my beloved John. It was what we chose to have as music for his 80th birthday, for his 90th birthday, at our wedding and at his funeral. I can't say it was our song, because it should be everybody's song.
Thank you very much, Jill, for sharing your literary and musical private passions.
Thank you, Michael, for asking me. It's been wonderful.
Tis the gift to be simple, tis the gift to be free, tis the gift to come down where you ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend we shan't be ashamed. To turn, turn will be our delight, till by turning, turning we come round right. Tis the gift to be simple, tis the gift to be free, tis the gift to come down where you ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight.
William Warfield performing Simple Gifts from Aaron Copland's Old American Songs, with Copland himself there conducting the Columbia Symphony Orchestra. Michael Barclay's guest was the novelist Jill Peyton-Walsh. The producer was Jane Greenwood for Loftus. And if you'd like to download that programme or others in the series, just visit the Radio 3 website. Next week at the same time, Michael's guest is the historian Eamon Duffy. That's here on BBC Radio 3 at midday next Sunday. Well, if you've recently tuned in, a warm welcome to you from me, Jonathan Swain, on this chilly December Sunday. In a couple of minutes' time, our lunchtime concerts, pianist Janina Fiakowska at London's Wigmore Hall in a selection of pieces by Chopin. First, though, at 1 o'clock, a summary of the news. The former First Minister of Scotland, Alex Salmond, has confirmed his intention to run for a seat at Westminster in next year's general election. He'll stand in the Aberdeenshire constituency of Gordon. Its current MP, the Liberal Democrat Sir Markham Bruce, is stepping down at the election. There's a warning that the increasing number of drones being flown by amateur enthusiasts could endanger commercial aircraft. The Civil Aviation Authority has confirmed that a drone came close to an airliner at Heathrow in July this year. The CAA has called on drone flyers to limit the altitude of their devices to 400 feet and to respect prohibited zones near airports. The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, has said the Conservatives are not being straightforward with voters about the scale of the cuts which they're planning. He said a future Conservative government would remorselessly pare back the state, hitting public services very hard. A Deputy District Judge has resigned because of comments he made in court about an Asian woman. During a case at Preston Magistrates Court, Judge Richard Hollingworth is reported to have said, with a name like Patel, she can only be working in a corner shop or off-licence. He remains a senior immigration judge, but has withdrawn from all judicial duties. American officials say six men who've been held at Guantanamo Bay for 12 years have been released. The men, four Syrians, a Tunisian and a Palestinian, will be resettled as refugees in Uruguay. The British Embassy in Cairo has been forced to suspend public services for security reasons. It's not known exactly what prompted the decision. The office of the British Consulate General in Alexandria is operating as normal. The Archbishop of Canterbury says more needs to be done to stop families in Britain from going hungry. Justin Welby said he was more shocked by poor families in Britain than he was by the poverty in Africa, because it was so unexpected. And the weather, there'll be a mixture of sunny spells and showers in most areas, and substantial snowfall is expected across the Scottish mountains. News and weather here on BBC Radio 3 at coming up to 2.5 minutes past one. Well, now the Radio 3 lunchtime concert, first broadcast live last Monday at Wigmore Hall in London, was Sarah Moore Peach.
Hello and welcome to Wigmore Hall in London for this sold-out recital by the Canadian pianist Janina Fiakowska. 12 years ago, she discovered a cancer in her left arm, which meant it couldn't be used at all for 2 years, but she has remarkably recovered. And since then, she's limited her repertoire to only that which she loves and also trusts. Well, her love affair with the music of Chopin goes right back to when she was a child and first started playing the piano. Her mother was a pianist and taught her, and her father was Polish, so Chopin's music very much in her blood. And today she's giving an all Chopin recital. She's going to play one each of the musical forms which Chopin focused on in his solo piano repertoire. There's a nocturne, an impromptu, a prelude, a set of mazurkas, a ballade. And she's starting with the Polonaise Fantasy in A-flat major, opus 61, which Chopin wrote in 1846. The Polonaise is a processional dance, which would have been the first one danced at a ball in Poland. This comes from 1846, when he was just towards the end of his relationship with Georges Sand, and the piece lasts over 10 minutes. Here to play Chopin's Polonaise Fantasy in A-flat major, opus 61, is the Canadian pianist Janina Fiakowska. Thank you.